Hi, it's Karen Webster for Payments.com, and I'm here today with Nick Craig, VP of Sales for CA Digital Payments, which is part of CA Technologies. Nick, thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Karen. Good to talk again.
Yes, it's always good to catch up, and here we are. It is almost June, the six-month march to, well, not quite 6 months now. It's a shrinking window to the transition to EMV here in the U.S. And what I'd love to talk to you about is your experience in helping issuers in particular migrate to this new environment. So let's talk about fraud. I think we all certainly expect that with this migration, offline fraud will decline, but we also know that online fraud tends to spike. I'd love to get your experiences as you've done this with other issuers around the world. What is it that we can expect here in the U.S.? And more importantly, what can we do about it?
For sure. So I think it's well understood, really, that the EMV can have a significant impact in card fraud, certainly card present fraud. But really, in the case of online fraud, that could be just the reverse. In fact, that's what a lot of our experience suggests. EMV is a great technology, but it's not something that is going to solve the problem for all types of fraud. And as with any good fraud prevention strategy, a layered approach is really required. We have had an interesting position in looking at the market, having provided CMP solutions over the last 15 years or so. And we've obviously seen the EMV adoptions across many of those markets. And if we look at the statistics, really that just sort of reinforces what you and I are referring to in that significant jump in CMP fraud following an EMV migration. If you go back to Europe and certainly the UK, CMP rose by 60%, certainly more than 60%. In fact, it rose to represent about 60% of the total card fraud following the EMV migration. Or Australia followed a very similar path. They rose to about 39% of the total card fraud. And certainly closer to home, Canada, CMP rose to about over 230% in just a few years. So you can see the trend is there. What's interesting in the US is we're obviously looking at the October deadline and liability shift coming into effect, and we're already starting to see that migration of both volume from a 3D secure perspective and the number of transactions from merchants. We're seeing a significant uptick in the number of merchants that are moving over to 3D Secure, which indicates that fraud migration is starting to take effect as the US merchants start to look at ways of protecting themselves in that migration process. The thing that I think is also worthwhile identifying is the fact that when we look at the US market, unlike other previous EMV migrations, the US market is obviously not only a very large e-commerce market, but also is one of the last markets to adopt EMV. So in previous EMV deployments, the fraudster had really many other options perhaps open to them. And in case of the US, those options may be far less, which may actually help to make the problem worse rather than make it better. And I think the other thing that is important to identify is even if you took away the EMV migration, just the rate of online shopping growth compared to traditional brick and mortar is having quite a significant impact in online fraud. So even if the fraud rate stays the same, the actual volume increase is going to have an impact of fraud policies in place today.
I think that's a really good point, which is even if the rate of fraud remains the same because volumes are growing, with the online-offline convergence, you know, that number will get bigger. But the rate of fraud may not increase, and I think that's something worth noting, right?
Well, yeah, but I think in terms of card not present, it's important to recognize that if you look at card fraud and you look at card not present fraud, that on a global basis, the rate of card not present fraud from a basis point perspective, can range enormously. It can range from maybe just a few basis points of fraud up to hundreds of basis points of fraud. And that is a significant thing to try to deal with. And if we think about that as a threat, that's obviously going to have an impact in just how quickly that migration can take place.
Maybe this is a crazy question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because that's just what I do, Nick. But we talk about the fact that fraud migrates. And I think we all accept that it does. But why? I mean, what is it specifically that the cyber criminals are doing? Are they using credentials that they've stolen previously, but they're using them online? Is there some other thing that they're doing? Why is there that shift?
Sure. I mean, a lot of that is to do with general trends in the market. I mean, obviously, we've been seeing large high-scale breaches in the past 18 months, 2 years, and that obviously has an impact to the amount of credentials that are out there that are available. And generally, fraud is becoming much more industrialized, institutionalized, from the standpoint of being able to lay your hand on a range of tokens, credentials, to be able to form an attack. So I think there's an element of it that is driven by that. But also, when you start to think about fraud as a whole, obviously when you start to apply and make certain vectors more difficult for fraudsters to attack, you know, the fraud is not going to go away. It's obviously going to move from place to place. So there will be an opportunistic element to that, and being able to jump from one form to the other. And certainly the card-not-present fraud, I think, represents an attractive opportunity for the fraudster, because they're able to work through a significant volume. They're able to operate on a global basis, and they can do that at the comfort from their own living room, right? So, you know, this is something that it doesn't face the same sort of physical barriers that perhaps other fraud attack would face. It is something that can be done almost instantaneously. And I think that has a lot to do with it.
Just to be specific, so it's not as if they're stockpiling credentials that they may have accumulated or acquired through physical point-of-sale hacks, but they're simply shifting the field of play to the digital world where commerce is accelerating. Is that more or less what's happening?
Yeah, but it's also the fact that you don't have a single person or group of people that are doing the end-to-end fraud attack. There are, you know, when we talk about this becoming more professional, there are groups of people out there that are focused on getting the credentials and monetizing the credentials and selling those elsewhere. There are others that are taking those credentials, buying them, and trying to use those across a variety of different attack vectors. So it's not just one group of people, clearly, although, you know, these criminal gangs, they certainly are becoming a lot more professional in terms of the way in which they are operating.
Yeah, no, that for sure. Well, let's talk about a complexity associated with fraud in a digital environment. And I think it speaks to the expertise of the cyber criminal. So my understanding is that about half, not quite, but close enough, of fraud happens to be across multiple devices, because that is, in fact, the way in which consumers use. They sort of multi-home between their laptop, their smartphone, and their tablet, and that is with multiple cards. So doesn't that make the environment for detecting and preventing fraud that much more complicated? I mean, the separating the "this is really fraud" from "this is Karen" using a different card on a different device, but it's really Karen.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, to identify the sort of connection between the devices that are being used and the cards that are being used is really important. And we obviously talked about, you know, how the e-commerce fraud is a global problem. Fraud can migrate very quickly, et cetera, et cetera. But fundamentally, when you start looking at those transactions, and in particular with the use of programs such as 3D Secure, that insight becomes quite important to the shopping habits, the type of devices that are being used, the profiles of those devices, the specific characteristics that those devices may have, and the location preference for those devices. So even if you were just to take a device, the ability to collect and gather information in and from that device is quite significant. And certainly for issuing banks, they don't necessarily have that opportunity. They don't have that opportunity to collect that data without programs such as 3D Secure. So when you look at the sort of card device association, it really sort of reinforces what the majority of us might think about the way in which we run our lives and how we operate. You know, our data science team completed a study recently on millions of transactions, and they found that the majority of the cards were transacted, just all transactions, not looking at fraudulent transactions, but all transactions. Majority of those are done on not more than a couple of devices.
Hmm.
But the interesting thing is that as the number of devices increase for the cards that are being used, the fraud rate starts to jump as the number of devices increases. So if you go beyond maybe five devices being used on a single card, the fraud rate jumps maybe 14 times and goes on in that factor. So that just highlights really the values that device can bring to being able to identify suspicious behavior, being able to identify genuine behavior, and sort of reinforces what most people talk about and most people think when thinking about, you know, the way in which they operate and how they shop. But that's just one metric, right? I mean, if you look at the device as a metric or just one metric, it can lead to misconceptions and can lead to higher false positive rates. So even if you are seeing, you know, 14 times the fraud rate on, you know, devices greater than 5, that's still a significant volume of transactions. So you really have to take a much broader perspective, both in terms of the types of data that you can collect about that device, but also the wider context of the transaction itself. The types of purchases that are being made, is this electronics, is this jewelry, the type of behavior that the cardholder might have experienced before, where in the world the cardholder is connecting from, what type of things have they purchased before, and is that consistent? So that wider context is really important. So, you know, the device is obviously a great tool for us. Being able to capitalize that in the context of a broader genuine customer experience is very important. Challenge, of course, is how you make those decisions in real time. There's a lot of data, a lot of information. How do you do that in real time?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think that brings to mind the real trade-off that merchants in particular consider when they're trying to absorb what to do and what kinds of things they need to be implementing to mitigate fraud. You mentioned that you're seeing an uptick in the number of merchants that are really looking to deploy 3D Secure, which has, you know, had a very mixed reputation because of the early days. The way it was presented to consumers was difficult. It compromised conversions, and that's of course the thing that merchants don't want compromised. They're willing to absorb a little bit of risk in order to make the sale. I'm curious to know what your ROI story and business case story is to merchants now. I know 3D Secure has come a long way since the early days, but maybe you could, you know, kind of put the business case, the use case, in context for us.
Sure. So when you think about 3D Secure, I mean, fundamentally, the question is, can you implement a 3D Secure solution? And is it going to enhance or improve the metrics, right? And if you can't show that, then clearly, you know, throw it out the door and move on. Fundamentally, you know, 3D Secure offers significant opportunities that just aren't available in a non-3D Secure transaction. So when you think about the previous experience, fundamentally it boils down to three things. Can you identify fraud more effectively using 3D Secure than without it? Can you improve the cardholder experience? And can you balance that cardholder experience against the fraud detection? Yes, you can run a 3D Secure program, or you can run a set of transactions through and target the fraud by declining or whatever it might be. But if you can't do that by balancing the cardholder journey, that then becomes really difficult to do. So when we think about, you know, those two broad objectives, the thing that 3D Secure really brings is the opportunity to gather those insights and get a much broader perspective, not just at a bank level or indeed a merchant level, but across the entire portfolio of transactions that are being seen. So CA, I mean, we operate across 13,000 different portfolios around the world. And so that insight is hugely valuable in being able to identify suspicious behaviors and being able to identify the trends and behaviors. So if you think about those metrics and you think about the data that can be collected and what can be achieved, we're now in a position where you're able to implement a 3D secure solution without being able to affect the cardholder journey if that's what you want to. The idea that you have to implement 3D secure and you have to do that challenging all transactions all of the time, and you have to use a static password or something like that, those days are well gone. Mm-hmm. The opportunity to use the data, to be able to use that data for far greater levels of intelligence, and to be able to really pinpoint the suspicious behavior using some of the analytical capabilities that we built into our platform gives a huge benefit. Well, I mean, we have customers that are out there that are implementing solutions just in a matter of weeks, right? This is not a big project. And we have customers that we've worked with to implement 3D Secure without challenging a single transaction, and yet still being able to have a very significant impact to the fraud bottom line. And what's really interesting is if you compare, we have one customer that we work with, if you compare the idea of using analytics rather than just taking a standard policy, one size fit all, just using analytics, yes, you can address the fraud problem to quite some degree. But in addition to that, the experience for some of our cardholders or for some of our issuers is that they have seen the shopping frequency rate increase, certainly significantly greater than other portfolios that are sort of the traditional 3D secure portfolios. I saw nearly a double the velocity, double the frequency of shopping, and maybe even double the shopping basket rate compared to other traditional 3D secure portfolios. So,
really?
The idea that, 3D secure is a bad thing or, affects cardholder experience, that we as an industry, we have to do a much greater job, a better job of being able to communicate the value that 3D secure really brings. And being able to do that in a way that gives the issuers the full control of being able to operate that.
So, Nicky, you've mentioned a lot of really interesting things throughout our conversation that I would put into the category of myth busters. So you talked about, you can't really just look at one metric. You talked about the fact that, 3D Secure isn't synonymous with, bad conversions because it has evolved to really being a hugely efficient set of analytics that run in the background that increase conversion. You talked about the importance of being able to have access to insights in real time and lots of them. What are some of the other myths that you think we need to break through as we make this journey throughout the EMV migration and, undoubtedly fraud moves from one channel offline to another?
Sure. I mean, ultimately, what most of our customers are focused on is improving the cardholder and the customer experience. We're operating in a world that has just far greater levels of competition, certainly from a card perspective, than just a few years ago. The opportunity for alternative payments, the range of card products that are available is hugely competitive, and certainly cardholder experience is front and center to everything that we do. So, it is very important that we really try to change the dimension of how we think about these problems and think about this purely from the standpoint of the customer. If you start from the customer and you work backwards from there, or indeed forwards from there, you're going to start to see insights that are very different. The customer journey itself is a very complex one. And actually, in many cases, a merchant or indeed a bank may not have full control of that journey, right? And so typically what you see is an over-reliance on control points or systems that have been effective in the past to solve the problem, right? We're seeing an increase in fraud, therefore we need to increase the decline rate that, or the intervention rate that we're seeing. And the challenge, of course, is that when you're dealing with a mass consumer experience, just a small amount of friction can lead to a very significant impact. One good example, right? So if you're using a single method of authentication, right, across all of your customer groups, that's unlikely to be effective, both from a fraud prevention standpoint or indeed a customer experience standpoint, right? The world has moved on. Customers' expectations are very different. The idea of having to use different methods of authentication depending on the channel that you use, the engagement point you use, is missing the point entirely, missing the opportunity to really reinforce the customer journey. So if there are many different customers and there are many different groups and many different types of customers that are out there, mass consumers are going to operate very differently from a VIP customer, a commercial portfolio. So you really have to put the customer at the heart of that. It is a complex thing from the standpoint of the customer journey. And there is no one single silver bullet, but what is important is that there is an understanding of what that customer journey is, and that you can identify the areas in that customer journey that you can start to tweak, rather than trying to rely on the one or two control point or systems that have been effective in the past. And ultimately, that all comes down to an understanding of the data. If you don't understand how the transaction flow goes through today and where you are losing those transactions, then it's very difficult to implement a fraud strategy that is going to be effective against the cardholder journey. So the idea that you have to compromise the cardholder journey for the sake of a fraud prevention is really the myth that we have to start to push up against, because there are generally inefficiencies in the way in which that cardholder journey is treated today. And so if you can identify that and you can improve that, then it provides a great opportunity to optimize the cardholder journey whilst also addressing the fraud. And that's really the opportunity that presents to most banks and indeed merchants around the world.
I think that's great advice, which is follow the customer and their path to purchase, which of course is changing dramatically given the availability of mobile devices and the access to the internet that they provide. It's certainly going to be an interesting couple of decades, certainly, as we manage through the evolution of the change that's upon us. Nick, thanks very much for your time today and for your wise counsel on how to handle the migration and what's to follow. Thank you.
Thanks, Karen.